Welcome to Season 2 and another edition of The Informed Gardener with your host, Dr. Linda Chalker-Scott, Associate Professor and Extension Urban Horticulturalist at Washington State University. And now, the science behind gardening with Dr. Linda.
Hi, I'm Linda Chalker-Scott, and welcome back to Season 2 of The Informed Gardener. After that introduction, you might be wondering, what exactly does an Extension Urban Horticulturist do? Well, this one takes information from articles about plant science and translates it for use in your garden. With Thanksgiving coming up, I thought this week we'd look at some gardening turkeys. Not poultry, really, but some really terrible things people do and buy in misguided attempts to take care of their gardens. And as a counterpoint to those turkeys, we've brought back plantsman extraordinaire Riz Reyes, who's wearing his horticultural consultant hat in this week's interview. But first, let's look at some real turkeys in the garden products department. So any of you who've heard or read my views on many garden products know that I'm not exactly shy about telling you what I think. Some of these products are just a waste of your money and time, and other ones are just plain silly. But the ones that really get me hopping mad are those that result in environmental degradation, whether it's your garden environment or some other natural ecosystem nearby. With that in mind, let's look at my three least favorite gardening products. Well, the first one has to be landscape fabric, and this gets marketed under different names like geotextiles, you know, kind of appeals to if you've got more of a techie bent. Weed fabric, so, you know, if you're really out to get your weeds, this is something you can use. It's a chemical-free means of weed control. So here's a quote from ehow.com on how using landscape fabric in your garden can control weeds. And this is in quotes, "Landscape fabric is a breathable material that allows water to flow into the soil." So it sounds just great. Something that'll control weeds, but still you get your water and your air down to the roots and your soil organisms. But let's just take this apart a little bit. First of all, this whole breathability issue. Well, it makes sense. If you get this fabric, and I would invite you, if you don't have any, go buy a roll of it, cut a piece off, hold it up to the sky, and sure, you can see light through it. But then I want you to do a little experiment, and I actually do this as a demonstration. So cut a piece of this, put it over a bucket or a can or something, and pour water through it. Now, if it's the cheap stuff, water actually will pour right through it. But if you buy the expensive stuff, water sits on top and kind of drizzles through a little bit. And now we're going to get realistic. Fabric doesn't just stay nice, clean, pristine fabric. It's going to get dirt and other stuff blowing on top of it. So take that same piece of fabric, put some soil on top, and now try to pour some water through it. Guess what? It doesn't pour through. And why? Because all those little holes, that breathability part of the fabric, are now filled up with dirt. So this is what happens on your landscape. The fabric sits there, the holes fill up with dirt, rains come, water sits on top, weed seeds blow in, they start growing. So all of a sudden you have a weed fabric, literally a weed fabric, fabric with weeds growing on top. In the meantime, your roots, which are sitting underneath this mat of weeds, are getting no oxygen, no water, no fertilizer. So they're actually suffering, and you are nourishing a wonderful crop of weeds. I actually have a very good personal experience with weed fabric. When we moved into our current house about 12 years ago, there was a backyard garden that was pretty much nothing but horsetail and bindweed, too. You know, big enemies of your typical gardener. So I went out there with my shovel and my trusty weeders, and I started digging through this mass of weeds, and my shovel wouldn't go through more than about 6 inches of soil. So finally I started raking the soil back, and what did I find? Well, there was a layer of weed fabric down, which was completely coated with the roots and rhizomes of the horsetails and the bindweed. No other good plants, but lots and lots of weeds. So here I had to rake back all this soil, rip up this degrading, nasty fabric that was just nasty with roots of these weeds, and then throw it all away. So obviously it didn't do very well in terms of keeping weeds out. It just grew the weeds really, really well. And that comes to the third part of this permanence thing. Well, nothing is really permanent. Everybody should realize that. And weed fabrics are probably about the least permanent thing you can get in terms of maintaining your garden. And the reason is because these fabrics break down. If they're in the sunlight, they can break down in as little as 1 year. If you bury them, they might last a few more years, but stuff pokes through them. You know, moles and other types of digging creatures will dig through them. They don't stay a nice fabric, so they become a mess underground. So you pull that up, and then what do you do with it? You throw it away. So here you've taken what's supposed to be this great chemical-free, permanent way of reducing weeds, and now you're rolling it all up into a ball and putting it into the landfill and creating a solid waste problem instead. On to my second least favorite garden product, and this is anything with kelp in it. So kelp extract, kelp meal, liquid kelp, you name it. Or maybe it's under seaweed rather than kelp. Anything that has either seaweed or kelp in it just drives me nuts. The organic gardening catalogs love this stuff, and they're so excited about it being used as a fertilizer, a soil conditioner, a stress reducer, a disease suppressant, you name it, whatever is good, kelp fertilizer will do it. And the ads, you read these ads, and they're like a menu description from a really fancy restaurant, so here's one of them. Harvested from kelp beds in the Pacific Ocean off the northern coast of California. And I really don't think it's coincidence that they make it sound like a fancy menu item. So let's look at the effectiveness, and actually there's been a lot of research on whether or not kelp fertilizer is effective as a fertilizer or a soil conditioner, et cetera, et cetera. I've actually written more about this in lots of detail on my webpage on theinformedgardener.com. So if you want to see more of this excruciating detail, you can visit it there. But here's a quick summary, and actually this is in the words of the researchers themselves. Here's one. Manufacturers' claims for the benefits of these products goes beyond what is substantiated by the research. Here's another one. There appears to be little value in applying these products. The number of products on the market seems to outnumber the published papers. So that's what the researchers say that are actually doing this in an objective, quantifiable, and repeated way. They're finding nothing. They're products that really don't work, and we really are wasting our time and our money by using them. But in my mind, that's not even the worst part. And as I've said before on this program, if you have something you love doing in your garden, whether or not it's supported by science, more power to you. But I do draw the line at things that degrade an environment. Now, it's not that the kelp itself is bad for your garden because it's not going to hurt it one way or another. But the problem is that it's harvested from kelp beds. Well, you know what harvesting means. You can also call it clear cutting, or you can call it mining. In any case, what you're doing is you're taking all the plant life from this particular ecosystem, in this case, the ocean, and you're taking it away. And that's the building blocks of all the rest of the marine life. Everything that's in the ocean pretty much depends on the plants that are there, and the plants in the ocean are the big kelps. So when you're taking those away, you're actually degrading an entire environment just so you can make some fancy organic fertilizer. And this is what I think is one of the worst examples of greenwashing there is. It's taking something that's degrading an environment, marketing and packaging it, spending a lot of money and time, and trying to convince people that it's a good product. I would never buy this stuff, and I would encourage you not to either. I guess my third least favorite product is probably phosphate fertilizers. And so, yeah, it's another fertilizer, just like with kelp. But if you go to a garden center or a nursery and you look at the products, you'll see that, you know, easily half the things there are some kind of fertilizer or supplement or conditioner or whatever. It just seems to be all chemical-based. So that's where a lot of my products happen to sit. And phosphate fertilizers are often sold as transplant fertilizers, and oftentimes for improving flowering. They're sold for bulbs so you get bigger blooms, and for improving fruiting. And you can find all different kinds of stuff. It's that menu thing again. You can get bat guano or bone meal or soft rock phosphate. You know, there's all these different forms of phosphate. And here's another great catalog description of this soft rock phosphate. Comprised of the bony structures of prehistoric marine creatures mined in Florida from the best deposit in the country. You know, it's just like something you read about wine, you know, produced in the best wine-producing region of France. It's the same type of thing. It's a heavily marketed item. So do you really need this stuff? Well, phosphate is a very important macronutrient, and everything alive requires phosphate. But in non-agricultural soils, this would be like your garden or your landscape, you probably have enough phosphate. And really the only way you know for sure is to get a soil test. And this doesn't mean going again, maybe this is number four in my marketing list, don't buy one of those soil test kits from the nursery because they're not going to do a good job of accurately telling you how much phosphate you have. You're going to have to spend, you know, $10, $15 to get a good soil test done, but it's going to give you exactly how much phosphate is in your soil. So again, if you don't have phosphate, if your phosphate is zero, sure, you should add some. But I'd be willing to bet my paycheck that you've got more than enough phosphate sitting in your soil right now. So what happens if you add this transplant fertilizer, whether it's bat guano or soft rock phosphate or whatever it is? If you add more than the soil needs, you start causing some problems. Over and above normal levels of phosphate hurt soil microbes and ultimately plants. The reason for this is that high levels of phosphate are detrimental to mycorrhizae. And if you remember, mycorrhizae are the gardener's best friend. It's those neat little microbes that colonize plant roots and actually help the plant take up more water and minerals than it normally could on its own. So you really want your trees and shrubs to have mycorrhizae on their roots. If you have too much phosphate, though, the mycorrhizae will not infect the roots, and then they just sit there and have to grow on their own without their little fungal partner helping them out. This is not a good thing for plants because it puts them in an additional bit of stress, and they're having to spend more time and energy taking up water and nutrients that normally the mycorrhizae would do for them. So you're hurting your plants by putting too much phosphate on them. That's the main thing that's a problem with adding too much phosphate to your landscape in terms of your own plant and soil health. But again, if we look past your own landscape and look at the environment around you, you can have some really serious effects on the health of the environment. If we stop and we look outside our home gardens and landscapes and look at the surrounding environments, you're going to find that there's other unintended consequences you can have from adding too much phosphate. What happens is if you have too much phosphate for either the plants to use or the soil microbes to use, it's going to run off somewhere. And whatever somewhere is always ends up in water. What happens in aquatic systems, especially freshwater systems, is that algae use a lot of phosphate to grow, and that usually is what's limiting to their growth. So if you add more of this nutrient, you get a lot of algae growing. It's what they call algal blooms, and you've probably heard of algal blooms before. So you get all this plant growth, which actually is kind of good initially because it means you get lots of other things growing as well. But the problem is eventually the phosphate runs out, and then all that algae starts to die. So your algal bloom becomes algal death. And when you have algal death, that means then the microbes go crazy. So the bacteria in there start going nuts because they've got all these little dead algae cells to chomp on. And when the bacteria go nuts, they use up all the oxygen. And when they use up all the oxygen, then the fish die. So you've probably heard before that these algal blooms cause fish kill, and they don't directly cause the fish kill, but it's that whole chain of events with the algae growth, the algae death, microbe growth, oxygen depletion, fish death. So that's the whole chain of events, and that's how you get these fish kills because of too much phosphate. So every time you add too much phosphate fertilizer, you need to think, where is that extra phosphate going? And if it's going downstream, it's going to cause problems in the long run. So again, you really want to take a soil test, find out if you need to add phosphate. And if you do need to add phosphate, make sure that you're only adding enough to really meet the needs of your plants. Today we've got a really fun interview. We've gone out on a field trip again, this time to Sky Nursery in Seattle, and we're meeting up again with Riz Reyes, who you might remember from season one of the Informed Gardener podcast. And today he's being a horticultural consultant. It's one of the many things that he does so well. He's actually going to be helping my podcast engineer, Shelley, choose plants for her yard for an all-year interest garden, and specifically something that'll stay nice in the winter and then hopefully go into spring and summer so that you don't have dreary dead plants sitting in containers and in your yard. You can actually have something that's fun to look at.
Fall, winter time typically tends, most people kind of shut down. They stay inside, but because we're in the Pacific Northwest, and if you heard the podcast from last season, we talked about how we live in a climate that is incredibly just awesome. We have so many plants that can grow in this region, and there's really no excuse not to garden year-round. This is a great time where, yes, it's getting chilly, we're getting some frost now, but you could visit a nursery. There's so much still to see and to purchase and to put together in a garden so you can have plants year-round. So that'll be our goal.
So, Riz, I have a duplex house that I moved into. It has a little backyard. I'm really interested in, you know, if there's any way to have color year-round, some type of color year-round, whether it's the leaves themselves or... So I look to you for your expertise.
All right. So you described your site, and ideally what would be great is to visit the site and actually have a look and see and visualize it. Actually dig in the dirt and look to see how horrible the soil is. So, but what we can do for today, though, based on that description, it sounds like... temporarily, for now, you know, get some interest and get some color in that spot, and that's going to deal with using containers. One famous garden designer, Penelope Hobhouse, I remember she had mentioned, she was asked what if she had one tip for a new gardener, you know, brand new, young or old, and she says, simplicity. So keep things simple. Okay.
Simple works for me.
Exactly. So we can start there, and then you know, if you catch the gardening bug, which I think you will, we can slowly expand. So first of all, when talking about containers, let's talk about the containers themselves.
Okay.
You have many different options for containers in our area. I tend to tell people to invest in a good quality container. There's clay pots, ceramic ones, there are wooden ones, there's a wide variety of different containers. And the one I often recommend, they're more pricey, but I think it's well worth the investment, are the glazed ceramic containers. A lot of them come from Asia. They're either made in Cambodia or Vietnam. Some come from China. But they have a protective glaze that prevents them from cracking in our area. So they're well protected. They can withstand our winters here. And they come in a wide variety of different styles, different colors. So whatever it is, I recommend getting a glazed ceramic container.
Well, we've looked at pots, and Shelley has chosen some red containers. And so now Riz is going to follow Shelley around as she looks at plants to figure out what will work in her red containers.
Wow, red. Okay, fiery, vibrant, kind of expresses a little bit of your personality. I'm feeling it. So we have a wide range of plants to choose from. And most people, again, newbie gardeners, they go to a nursery, they are overwhelmed. A lot of beautiful things to see. Where do you start? I always recommend to start with, we go from the biggest to the smallest. And for the biggest, I often look to trees and shrubs to start. And now a container obviously is much smaller than a plant that's going to be in the ground. But also keep in mind that containers, as versatile as they are, they also, that's the point, they're versatile, that you can change plants out. As plants get too big, you can take them out, and it's, you can change it up as often as you like. Some gardeners like a more, permanent, low maintenance, just kind of put it, set it, and, sort of forget it. They just have to water, once a week. But some people like the extravagance, like they'll change it up several times during the season to get the most impact and color. So being that you're a busy woman, we are going to go with a relatively low maintenance, low care, something that's going to be attractive year-round. So we're going to look at a few trees, mostly shrubs, I think, that will, I think, fit the bill. This is actually, have you heard of Oregon grape?
No, I haven't.
Oh, okay. So it's not really a grape, is the thing. But the genus, the plant, it's called Mahonia, and it's in the Barberry family. And this is a Mahonia, they call it Mahonia X Media, and this is a variety called Charity. So Mahonia Charity, it's the name. What's excellent about it is the foliage. It has foliage year-round. And it's very architectural. It is kind of spiny. It's funny, if you have bad neighbors or anything like that, or, have issues with them, you can kind of, plant this and they'll be like, whoa, they kind of take a stand back, but architecturally as a plant, it's very valuable because, like I said, it's evergreen and it's a winter bloomer.
Oh, wow. Okay? Wonderful.
So this will get to be quite large, but again, you can keep it in a container. If it gets too large in a container, you can take it out. But what's great is it has these sprays of yellow flowers that begin, I'd say December, and then continue on to January, even to February.
Wow.
It's spectacular. And hummingbirds, Shelley, hummingbirds love it.
All year, all throughout the fall and early winter?
Beginning late fall, I will say, and then into the winter, it actually comes into bloom. It's awesome.
So these are about 2 feet now in their pots, mm-hmm. relatively speaking.
Yeah.
So you're saying they can get how high?
These, if these were in the ground and left to grow and establish, they can get, around 10 feet high.
Wow.
And about 8 feet wide. So too big for your containers here that we picked out. But what you can do is you can actually grow this in a container for, I would say, 2 to 3 years,
uh-huh.
And then at that point, it'll probably start getting to be too large. You can take it out and then move something else in. But it's still a good chunk of time that you can actually enjoy the plant and enjoy the flowers in the wintertime. And it's a good background plant. So again, we talk about starting from the big to, then we're going to work our way to the small.
Okay.
This is one of your big installs, I guess, in this container. And this will probably be placed towards the back mm-hmm. of the container. So it's your background plant. And then, so now that you have your background set, you have your canvas in a way to work. So now we can look for a few more shrubs that are a little bit more colorful and have a lot more punch. Okay, so we're moving along here at the nursery, and I'm finding some really nice selections here at Sky. So this is another plant that I like to use a lot in containers, and it's called Lecothoe. And this is a cultivar called Rainbow, and you can see the splotching and the irregularness. Yes. Some people like this, some people don't. What do you think of it?
I do, actually. I like the color in the leaves.
Okay.
Does that stay or does that change?
It does stay. So normally, Lecothoe, this particular species, is all green, but this is a variegated form, so it has these splashes of yellow and cream on it. And also, the new growth is kind of red, and as the winter progresses, as it gets colder, it actually turns a little red. So it has this red blush, bronzy tint to it. So what I love about Lecothoe is, again, it'll get to be a large shrub, but as a container plant, when you look at it, let's look at a small plant of it here. It has this wonderful droopy cascading habit to it.
Okay.
So again, it's evergreen and it has these fabulous leaves that you will see year round. But what I like about it is this drooping habit that it has, that it kind of arches. And what I like to do is I plant it in the edge of a container. So what it does is it'll fill and it'll spill. It adds a little bit of color, adds a little structure, and just easy care. And again, evergreen. Plant it, pretty much forget it until it gets, you know, too big, and then you have to, you know, move it out into the garden. But another great selection for a fall winter container. So we've looked at two plants now. You've got your background plant with the Mahonia, and then now we've got a spiller here with the Lecothoe. And so we've got a little green. We got most of the green. We've got the yellows. We've got the variegated. Let's get flashier. Add some punch. Okay, so we've moved from the trees and shrubs area because, think of the container. This process of putting a container together is pretty much the same process as designing a garden, really. So you start with what they call the bones of your landscape. It's the structural elements that hold your garden together, and that's with, you know, your evergreens and your trees and shrubs. So we've got your main structure now with the background and the height, with the Mahonia in the background of your container, and then we've got your spiller with the Lecothoe, and then now it's our time to add a little pizzazz.
Okay.
It's time to add some interest and color and texture, and there's a lot to choose from. And what's wonderful about Sky and every other garden center really here in the Seattle area is they everything has to look good, right? Because
right.
It has to attract customers.
Sure.
And what they do is they bring all these plants together that look fabulous at this time of year for easy access. So basically, you can pretty much go to this table, choose whatever you want, and you'll be good to go. So we're after some color, and we have some awesome color here. Very popular plant to use for container work are heucheras. They're also known as coral bells. And as you can see, there's a diverse range of them. Just a few years ago, they only came in green and purple. Now we've got oranges, we've got pinks, we've got blotches, we've got some that flower as well. I find that the purple varieties and the green varieties, as you know, plain, you know, looking as they are, they're actually tougher plants, in my opinion and from my experience. But the heucheras do pretty well throughout the fall and the winter season. You've got a red container, this fiery red container. So a lot of the dark purple heucheras, like this one called Obsidian, is great. And then you've got, and also if you look at a color wheel, red and green are kind of complementary colors. So we have wonderful green selections here of heucheras. And again, different textures and different forms do very well. And the classic winter plant I must share with you, which has both excellent leaves and flowers, so we're going to talk about flowers now, are hellebores. Hellebores are probably the most popular and most sought-after winter blooming perennial. And what's fabulous about hellebores are the foliage, first of all. They're lush, they're glossy, and they're evergreen. And at times, I will pick out a hellebore really just for its leaves, and the flowers are just kind of, you know, icing on the cake.
What is the lifespan of the blooms? When do they start then?
So the flowers of hellebores are actually the sepals, and they are the most attractive to look at, and they persist. So they start to flower and open, you know, late winter or late fall at times, and then throughout the winter and then into the spring. And they go through these beautiful changes. One, a red hellebore can open and then slowly age to a pale green. And there are some double flowered varieties, and they're just turning out more and more because they're tough. They're wonderful. And one of my favorite plants, or varieties, I should say, of hellebores is a variety called Ivory Prince. Ooh. And it is really royalty in the garden, I will say. So, in terms of foliage, it has a slight marbling of silver on the foliage. And then the flowers. So it does not flowering yet, but we can see the little photo. It's a beautiful kind of chartreuse green, kind of edged in white. And not really an edge, but fades to white at the, towards the edges. But it is absolutely spectacular in a container, even just by itself. We talk about simplicity, right? So, you know, minus the Mahonia and the Lakotobe that we talked about, you can just have this one hellebore and it can look fabulous all year round, just like this, even just for the leaves, and maybe add a little filler, you know, that can spill over, and that'll be it. That'll it can be, it's simple, elegant, and easy to care for, which is important.
These are all my trigger words. These are perfect.
Good. I'm glad this is helping. So we've got the hellebores going, and let's see. And let's talk euphorbias.
Okay.
Because one other important thing that to consider when putting together a container garden is, yes, we've got the flowers and they're the most showiest, you know, aspect of a plant, but what can be showy as well is texture in the garden.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So like the hellebores, for example, add a bold texture with their large glossy leaves, and the Lakothoe adds a little finer texture because they're smaller leaves, and then the Mahonia, fine texture, but at the same time, big, bold plant. You need to find something that, that again, to have a little contrast. The euphorbias I love using because they are, again, evergreen, but they have they hold up really well. And one of my favorite iconic images in a winter garden is a stand of euphorbias like this after a snowfall. And the mark of a good evergreen container, I find, is to set it out and let the snow fall. And if it still looks attractive with the snow on it, then it's success. I think you've got it.
I think so. So thank you. So, Riz, this is amazing. I cannot wait to get these potted.
And it's just a great way just for you as a newbie to get started and to explore gardening. Because in a way, this container of yours is your first own, you know, little garden. And that's where we need to start. So start small, start simple, and then expand from there.
Riz has created some terrific container gardens that you can see on his website, rhrhorticulture.com. This podcast is only one of the ways I provide science-based information for use in your own garden. For more, be sure to visit my webpage, theinformedgardener.com. It's my official Washington State University webpage, and it's full of great and free information. You'll also find archived podcasts from our first season there. Second, please join me and three of my colleagues at the Garden Professors blog. It's at gardenprofessors.com, and the four of us take turns posting on just about any gardening topic you can imagine. You can even add comments if you feel so inclined. And finally, for those of you who will never give up books until they're pried from your cold, dead hands, I've written three books that might be of interest: The Informed Gardener, The Informed Gardener Blooms Again, and Sustainable Landscapes and Gardens. You can find out more information on all three of these books at sustainablelandscapesandgardens.com. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Be sure to listen next time when our theme will be leftovers, which you can enjoy with your Thanksgiving leftovers.